Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest is Andrew Cole, and Andrew is a regular on this program. It's great to have him back. He's professor of political science at Hilbert College. Got to get it pronounced that right, Hilbert College. His books include State Structure and Genocide, State Power and Democracy, and he's a valued contributor to the book I had a great honor to edit called Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III, and the conflict in Ukraine did not end with the peace agreement on the 5th of September, a little over a month ago. It continues kind of sporadically, and I believe it's just a matter of time before it revs up to go back maybe to be even worse possibly than it was for weeks and weeks and weeks until finally this agreement was consummated in Minsk. Well, we'll see what happens. Andrew, it's great to have you back.
Hi, Stephen. It's nice to be back on today's program. What I would like to discuss for the interest of your listeners is what I will refer to as a political symptom and relate this political symptom to a cause. And I am sure once I discuss this political symptom and the cause, you can feel free to chime in because I know you have discussed these things on your program on many times. Now, what I would like to start off with to say that this political symptom, which I'm going to be identifying, is related to a much larger political cause. In addition, I would like to discuss the effects of this political cause to the interest of your listeners. Now, what I am referring to as the political symptom is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known as ISIS. In fact, it's just been renamed the Islamic State. And as I'm sure many of your listeners, and I'm sure, Stephen, you're well aware of, if you look at the images from the corporate media, what have we been bombarded with, which is certainly of sensational interest, but obviously quite superficial. We hear and see about the beheadings, the amputations, and the torture done by ISIS, by this supposed brutal group of warrior jihads, who have, by the way, defeated the Syrian and Iraqi military. They have also defeated the Kurdish Peshmerga militia. And, by the way, they have assumed control over a territory in the Middle East even greater than the territory of the United Kingdom. And as of this moment, ISIS has assumed control over 4 million people and has even now been placed under its own control oil fields. So obviously, just from these descriptions of ISIS, this is difficult. They are difficult to ignore. Now, we also have, of course, transmitted through the corporate media, the various responses of Obama administration officials. The president in particular has, and I'll do my best to characterize, to paraphrase here, he's referred to ISIS as a cancer and obviously need to be eradicated. The Secretary of State calls ISIS the, somewhat, if I remember this, the face of ugly, savage, nihilistic, valueless evil, which must be, I think she said, destroyed, eradicated. Even the Joint Chief of Staff chimed in, talked about ISIS as advocating apocalyptic end of days strategic vision. So obviously the administration officials, just from my few comments, have been doing their best to demonize ISIS. And this is not to downplay their actions, but I want to further explain what ISIS is and what is exactly going on underneath what the corporate media is presenting us with these sensational images of ISIS. Now, one thing we do see, which is to me the obvious implication of such, you know, bellicose and, you know, confrontational statements made by various Bush administration officials, is the predictable response. And what has that been? It has been increasingly to bomb, to use drones, to now where we're at, of course, sounds all the more familiar, the talk of sending in troops. Now, support for supposed disaction, according to the Bush administration, is from an odd mixture of what they have been referring to as a coalition of the willing. And these are nothing more than elements that had been at various points in time supportive and hostile to the Assad regime and to Syria.
Andrew, one quick point. I'm sure you meant the Obama administration, not the Bush administration.
Oh, sorry. My slip up there, Steve. Yeah.
But you can bet the Bush administration, the Bush people are right in league with Obama and everything going on.
It's such a crossover. I find myself when I'm talking about one administration, there's the other.
Change,
yes.
But the policies stay the same.
Oh, they sure are. Now, Since you, I'm glad you pointed that out to me. That's exactly what I want to do, take us a little back in time from the Obama administration to the Bush administration. And I think some history can give us some sense as what is going on, what are really this, what I call political symptom of this current ISIS crisis. Now, look back at not too long ago to the post 9/11 war on terror, which we all know became during the Bush, and let's get to the Obama administration too, as a global war. Now, when we look at the Bush administration, what did they say about this global war? And I remember this quote, I believe Bush said it, it just so stuck in my mind when he talked about waging this global war. He said he said, I'm going to drain the swamp. So he's going to go around the world sending the troops, committing our forces to drain the swamp of terrorist groups, to get to uproot this, you know, and drain the swamp in close to 60 countries. That's still been the goal, by the way. So troops are sent, drones dispatched, and this continues during Obama administration to confront, which I would characterize as essentially little tiny nationalist bands in remote regions of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, you name it. Now, for Bush, and again, this ties Bush to Obama, this crusade amounted to, regrettably, and again, I just want to paraphrase here, is a religious war. But it became, in part, not just a religious war, but a war against Muslims. So this wasn't just Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Now, let's start to move forward and get to Bush, Obama, and this business of ISIS and what it really represents. When you send, as the U.S. has obsessively sent, its troops displaying its military might with the wholesale destructions of country in this so-called war on global terrorism, what have we done, essentially? What has the U.S. essentially done during both of these administrations? It has essentially destabilized a number of countries, and it has, in some ways, which I want to get to now, start to establish a foundation for the basis for ISIS to emerge. And again, if you look back at both administrations, this war on terrorism has really blackened U.S., the United States, more than it has been in its recent past. All what we see in the context of this global war is these horrible images coming out from Abu Ghraib, the leaks about the CIA torture and abuse in these black sites. We have images of an Apache helicopter, this is released by WikiLeaks, by the way, of American pilots shooting and killing Iraqi citizens in the streets of Baghdad. We also have U.S. troops urinating on the bodies of dead Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. Finally, we have the despicable display of what I call trophy photos of body parts brought back home by U.S. soldiers. And if that is not all, we have this insensitive use of killing from a distance, and creating, which I'm sure a fair number of your listeners probably have heard of and have not seen, what I call snuff films. These are these drone assassinations, which many of the pilots, if your listeners may or may not be aware of, they refer to them as bug splats. That's the common language. That's how human beings in other parts of the world are being referred to. Now, we also have, finally, the Bin Laden kill film, part of the raid in Pakistan, with President Obama watching as Bin Laden is essentially assassinated. He's watching by a live feed. So now let us try and tie some of this, all this together, to try and get to why we have this thing called ISIS. What I'm suggesting to your listeners is that if you look at the sum total of what I've already described, you look at the various invasions during Bush-Obama administrations, you look at the occupations, you look at the drones, the killing of civilians, the hundreds of thousands of deaths, the massive refugee problem. What I am suggesting is, given all this, what you have by what I call a sum total of various seeds that have been planted, which are now germinating towards creating what I would call an extreme response to U.S. military extremism. So what is now the end result, and we're seeing the process further accelerated, is in many of these countries where the United States has had a military presence, it has resulted in instability, many destructive conditions, which end result create insurgencies, civil wars, extreme militias, which ISIS exactly is, which are essentially filling the void of governments which we have collapsed through our military intervention. So what I am dare suggesting, that in the end, the growth of what we call ISIS as an extreme nationalist force is, I would say, is in large part a product of U.S. foreign policy. So what I want to also say further on is that when you look at ISIS, it is finally the product of 13 years of regional wars, a destructive U.S. occupation during the Bush-Obama administrations. Now, furthermore, what I consider most significant is that many of the ISIS leaders came from the Iraqi army that the U.S. disbanded. And this is an inconvenient fact that the corporate media certainly does not want to talk about. Also, that these former Iraqi military officials began to perfect their skills in the prisons that the U.S. Set up. And later on, during their experience in confronting the United States counterterrorist operations in the years of that so-called U.S. surge. So now the foundations of ISIS are clearly being put in place. In other words, and I'm suggested that through the military occupation, the U.S. has built in Iraq really a country so weak, so devastated, a government that cannot have the ability to deal with these former Iraqi military leaders, which are now ISIS fighters. And if you look at how ISIS grew into the potent military force that it is, because they were simply able to know how to get access and get a hold of many of the weapons that, by the way, have been abandoned and sit in these vast weapons depots, which ISIS fighters now have gotten their hands on. Now, interestingly, and let's get back to the corporate media coverage, and this I find extremely important, that certainly for sensational and ratings purposes, the corporate media certainly telecast on more than one occasion the video execution, I believe it was Jane Foley, and this was supposedly great evidence, certainly for Bush administration officials to say, look how horrible ISIS is and look how bloodthirsty they are. But I want to suggest another possible interpretation other than the one of ISIS being these fanatical maniacs that are just targeting people to behead them and, you know, film it on the on a video. I am there suggesting that this is a deliberate calculation on the part of ISIS to do what the U.S. is currently doing, and that is to have the U.S. react by responding to force and intervene. And let me tell you what the end result has been, which the corporate media certainly does not really understand in its coverage of ISIS. The more the U.S. begins to intervene and resort to various force and bombings and et cetera, it is only strengthening ISIS. And as a result, ISIS is now enlisting more recruits and clearly now has an enemy which it is targeting, and that is the United States. Now, the ultimate goal is to have the Obama administration, which it is currently doing, and I believe ISIS has succeeded in doing that, is to commit a large social, large-scale intervention. So, I kind of hate to say this, but we certainly, if I may explain it in this way, we haven't learned from our past history, because what the Obama administration is doing is what many administrations, Democrat and Republican, have done in the past, in not too dissimilar situations. In other words, mission creep is clearly underway, as it had been if you look back and consider the policies of the Johnson administration and even the Nixon administration, the failed Vietnam policy of what was known as Vietnamization. This is now being tried in Obama administration and its tackling of ISIS. Now, what was the U.S. doing, which to me amounts to kind of a repeat of Vietnamization? First, we have the U.S.-trained and U.S.-supplied Iraqi army in Mosul and other cities seeking to take on ISIS itself, and that, of course, it is in response to ISIS attacks in Mosul. Now, then we have the aircraft carrier H.W. Bush sent 100 planes to the Persian Gulf and sent in as well hundreds of troops and advisors. So again, here we go, bit by bit, as we had in Vietnam, saber-rattling advisors, small number of troops, and now the other aspect of this, as ISIS further extended its military control by getting rid of its rival, I believe they're called the Yazidis, I think it's spelled Y-A-Z-I-D-I-S. This was a small religious sect which they got rid of. Now the U.S. can further engage in mission creep to say that it has a humanitarian crisis to deal with persecuted minorities. So what do we get? Like Vietnam in the mid-1960s, we get an extended bombing campaign, which clearly is what Johnson was doing. Now, let's continue with, we have the Kurdish Peshmerga militia was also crushed by ISIS. That was further justification for the Obama administration to say other minorities are being persecuted. Now we get a further extension of the bombing campaign, which had started earlier. Now we have, this is pretty much where we're at, more troops and advisors are being sent in day by day. And again, given the sensational response to the beheading video, now we have the bombing campaign further extended to Syria and drone surveillance now also over Syria to prepare for additional bombing campaigns. Now, let me try to move on and try to tie this in terms of what my brief summary of ISIS can tell us. As I said at the start of the broadcast, that ISIS is just a symptom, a political symptom of a much larger problem, which I want to get to now. And that problem to me is first and foremost the problem of permanent war. And I know, Steve, you've talked about this on many of your programs. So
indeed.
Certainly feel free to chime in.
And I've written plenty about it too, Andrew.
Yes, I've read. It's been great writings on that, and I've listened to some of those broadcasts as well. And here's where ISIS ties into this. Certainly ISIS to me is just a symptom of a U.S. permanent war on terror. And I would like to borrow the words of an early 20th century social critic here, Randolph Bourne, I believe his name is. And he said, and it's a short little quote, it's a great quote, and he says, war has been the health of the state. But the question is, what kind of state? And I want to suggest to your listeners that this is a state, and if I may borrow from another author here, Seymour Melman, described in his interesting book, Pentagon Capitalism, this is the association which permanent war rests on between industrial, governmental, and military institutions, connected by a vested interest to prepare and wage war. So to me, this more than explains how the Obama administration can justify this, what I call, mission creep vis-a-vis ISIS. Now, Well, I'm about to cite, and I will try to minimize my use of statistics here, but some are quite relevant to bring to the attention of your listeners. This statistic to me is quite startling. And this is a current statistic. I wanted to make sure I looked it up to make sure because I read it elsewhere and it was quite shocking. And that is when you compare what the U.S. spends to other countries, clearly what you see, Melman's Pentagon capitalism is clearly at work. In other words, as of 2014, the official U.S. defense budget is currently $785.9 billion. That's 20% of the federal budget is going towards what I call a permanent war economy.
And before all the and that's before all the other categories are thrown in, Andrew.
Exactly.
If
exactly.
You throw them all in, you can double that number.
Exactly right. And there are other related defense expenses that, if I were to dig a little further, would make this total a whole lot higher.
By the way, Andrew, Seymour Melman is somebody I respect greatly. I've read a number of his books, and sadly he's no longer with us. But
yes,
if he was still living, oh, he would be a marvelous guest on this program.
Yes, I've read all his works, and certainly I drew inspiration from trying to get a sense of what is the institutional foundation for permanent war-making and why, once again, here we go, there's another manufactured enemy. And again, which, if I may read into what Melman and others have said, even Chalmers Johnson, in his books, as he has written, it's an institutional basis. This is reproduced. And, you know, the corporate media doesn't want to go anywhere near this. Now, getting back to this business of money and defense spending, also, if you look at, and this is current statistics, I don't know the exact number, but I do know more or less that the U.S. spends more on military expenditures than all other military powers in other parts of the world. Now, just this comparison, if you compare U.S. military expenditure to, say, Russia, to what's called the Russian Federation, and China, they only spend a third of what the U.S. spends. So clearly, we are, to me, regrettably, the world leader in military spending. We are no longer the economic superpower, but we still are, and I'll get to what the effects are, the world's number one spender in terms of maintaining our military power. Now, let's step back, and again, so much has been written about it, certainly Melman, Johnson, and so many others have written, but what certainly this is not radical stuff. I want to say this to your listeners. President Eisenhower himself said, I believe it was January 1961, his farewell address when he's leaving office, he himself warned of this quote-unquote military-industrial complex. He talked about its influence in the parts of the government and how we as Americans must guard against its what he called unwarranted influence of this military-industrial complex. So this former general leaving office, this former president, was well aware of the power of these sectors as to why we have permanent war, why would this we have this business with ISIS now. And here is what I want to talk about just briefly. If you look a bit closely at each sector, they do their own what I call division of labor to maintain this permanent war economy. But what they do collectively is that they are all vested in talking about, or in the case of ISIS and others, creating a threat. And to justify the creation of these weapons and monies, which is quite astounding, to maintain this permanent war making. So let me characterize in some ways what our national policy is. In a word, due to permanent war making, it is nothing more than a policy of militarism. Militarism has become the norm, by and large, of U.S. policy debates. And I don't want to try to prophesize, and I hope my prophecy does not come true. But if, for example, Hillary Clinton does decide to run for president, I can tell you, listeners, this, she is, without getting into all the particulars, she is even more hawkish and even more tied to the military-industrial complex, surprisingly, than now the current President Obama.
Oh, I agree.
I Yeah, I really hope that she does not run. Certainly, worst of all, I hope she doesn't ever get elected. Now,
we won't come November of 2016, Andrew. I'm afraid we won't have much of a choice. Like we never have much of a choice.
Yes, but I would suggest, and maybe this is not the thing to say to listeners in support of, you know, formal democratic principles, but. You know, if you look at most Americans, they simply don't vote. And I would say, then don't vote. I mean, non-voting is a protest. It's rejection of what the choices are. And the choices, I absolutely agree, are pretty paltry.
Ahead of the November 2012 election, Andrew, I wrote an article I titled, Vote Independent or Stay Home.
Yes, yes. I think, to me, in some respects, and I know there would be many people who would take issue with what I'm about to say, but non-voting does serve, in one sense, to delegitimate the political system, because they're counting on that legitimating factor to support class rule. And I say staying home and non-voting is to say, no, we don't accept the process. The process is rigged. But let me get back to this permanent war-making and
By the way, I love Ralph Nader's comment about the candidates that we get to choose from, calling them the evil of two lessers.
Yes. And I remember him saying, if I believe, I'm probably paraphrasing, he said, if you do that, if you buy the business that supposedly the Democrats, voting for a Democrat or a Republican, is the less of two evils, I believe he said, and correct me if I'm wrong, he said, you still get evil, he said.
Oh, you still do get evil. And what's going on now is really so appalling, Andrew. I've written a number of articles about the situation, and there's no question in my mind, the evidence is very strong that you can give them any name that you like, the Islamic State, ISIL, ISIS, and like-minded groups like the Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda, going back to the 1980s, the Mujahideen against the Soviets, and Afghanistan, America actively recruits these Thai people to wage its war off terror against whatever ever adversaries it wants to attack, it wants to weaken, it wants to destroy, it wants to replace. And the dirty game in the post 9/11 era was Afghanistan replaced the government there with a pro-Western stooge one. Same thing in Iraq, same thing in Libya, same thing in Syria, the conflict ongoing now, and uses these people as foot soldiers, as U.S. proxies, boots on the ground, to serve America's imperial agenda for regime change. So, you know, the screaming headlines, America going after this terrible terrorist group, well, that's the pretext, and the target is Syria, in the case of the war there, and the objective is regime change, to put a pro-Western stooge government in place of the Assad government, and Assad running for president, running for re-election as president, was overwhelmingly supported in the June election. Almost 89% of Syrians in an election that independent monitors judged open, free, and fair. I suspect, Andrew, more open, free, and fair than what passes for elections in America.
Yes, exactly. And if you look at why the U.S. continues to have, and now it's been for, over 50 years, such an interest in Middle East politics, certainly, if America is afraid of anything in the Middle East, it is afraid of democracy.
Oh, for sure.
The regimes that it supports. You can go to the Saudis. You could name them. You can rattle them off who the U.S. has supported, and they certainly let's not disassociate this enormous resistance to democracy in the Middle East. And by the way, the Middle East is one of the poorest regions in the world because you have this incredible gulf between those at the top and the rest of us who maintain control over oil, and that's what the U.S. wants to keep itself, you know, vested in the Middle East, in part because of oil. It certainly wants to have access to it. This is key to the United States, and to keep the Europeans out, because the Europeans are, and China, they're increasingly competitors there. And the way to do it is militarily. But, again, important to say to your listeners is that all this goes on because there are institutional foundations for this politics, for this war making. And again, if the best I can characterize it is what we have in these these institutional players, the military-industrial complex, which make for permanent war-making, is that they reproduce it. It doesn't just happen. It's not just an accident. It's not just spontaneous. These institutions are vested. They have an interest. They have a political, economic interest in this ongoing manufacture of threats, to which, again, commits the United States, unfortunately, towards waging these permanent wars. But I want to, again, say to your listeners, the costs are not just the destruction overseas, terrible as they are, but let us not forget something that sometimes people might forget when they think of troops going overseas and where we are in the world. They say, and to some extent I can almost understand it, not quite, when they say, oh, so what? This is halfway around the world. It doesn't affect me. But I would say to the contrary, it does affect you. This militarism perpetuated by the military and industrial complex has some very serious, increasingly serious domestic consequences. We cannot overlook them, and this is what I want to get at. So again, this is not just a foreign policy matter. This is a foreign policy that is directed to domestic policy. Now let's talk about some of the domestic effects of a permanent war economy. Now, what do we have? And I would again repeat what I said at the start of your program, referring to the word symptom. I would say that one of the symptoms of a permanent war economy is our continuing and ever-growing huge trade and budget deficits, and our fairly still high, in spite of what the corporate media would tell us, of unemployment and marginal employment. So we also have, which to me is a reflection of what I call a symptom, the sorry state of our U.S. infrastructure, because this dedication to divert funds away from the budget to this war economy. In other words, if I may use this characterization, I believe Martin Luther King even used it when he was starting to criticize, not long before he was assassinated, he was starting to criticize the Vietnam War. He said, the United States is choosing guns over butter. And that's exactly what I feel we are doing in a permanent war economy with the domestic impacts. And I want to get back to that, these social effects or domestic impacts. It is certainly, if I may speak on a social level, it is making America, if I may characterize it in this way, a less civilized country. That it, and if you look at it, and I'll talk more about this a little bit later, look at the whole behavior. Again, I don't want to get into too many particulars yet of the police. The police, increasingly militarized, are like an occupying force, and I say that is a domestic reflection of this militarism that is not just external, it is now internal, given that we are constantly, perpetually waging war. Now, look at what's also what I would call an effect of the war economy. Let's talk about American capitalism. Let's talk about American companies who are using hard-earned U.S. taxpayer dollars who ship this money overseas, and this seems quite politically perverse to me, who are rebuilding foreign countries. We are destroying these countries, exporting billions of dollars to rebuild these countries. Why? Just so they could be more amenable to corporate interests to set up shop and to do their global hunt for cheap labor. Now, for the troops committed to any number of these various military campaigns, let's talk about the troops committed, of the wounded veterans who received less than adequate care, who suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. This is a domestic effect of a war economy of excessive militarism. Now, let's also talk about it, and this to me has domestic consequences, that war is increasingly being privatized. It is increasingly an undemocratic practice. It is making America much more of a police state, much more dictatorial. And now, if you look at Blackwater and the use of mercenary armies, what do they do when they go overseas? They commit gross human rights violations, They've been involved in a number of vicious attacks on unarmed civilians. And this is now what the U.S. has to deal with, but also has to deal with it domestically. Now, let's talk about the domestic commitment to permanent warmaking. I say this with great regret as an academic. If you look at funding that goes to many colleges and especially universities, up to, and I looked this up, 70% of the research is being funded by the Pentagon, especially at the elite universities like MIT, Harvard, Yale, etc. But also even Hollywood is getting in on the act to culturally reinforce this militarism part of this warmaking. Now we see many a Hollywood movie, and I won't start citing all the particular movies, but they're being co-produced and even funded by a number of military experts. And by the way, some of these experts have links with big oil as well as the military. Now, but let's talk about everyday life of this, what I call militarized society. What are we seeing? And let me get back to this. I mentioned it a moment ago regarding the function of the police and all the sad incidents of this, what I call war on people on color. The local police departments have acquired a large number of very sophisticated weapons that primarily have been or were in use in war. You know, this is not supposed to be something you give to local police departments. Look at the United States now. What is the picture of local police departments? We have now heavily armed SWAT teams breaking into people's homes at all hours of the day and night, using military-style tactics, and using such things as, maybe your listeners are unaware of this, it's something called flashbang grenades. I never even heard of such a thing until I began to research the militarization of the police, but these flashbang grenades temporarily blind and deafen residents. Now, you might say, well, what's the purpose of, you know, bashing into people's houses and using these military-style grenades? The overwhelming majority of these break-ins into people's homes is simply to serve a search warrant. That is quite astounding, that what we used to think of local police as just knocking on your door and saying we'd like to search the premise is now pretty much under the control of the SWAT, who come in like they're, you know, attacking, how do you say, people who are heavily armed. Now, using federal money, state and local police agencies have acquired what I would call vast military arsenals. And sadly, look at the recent shooting of Michael Brown in Missouri. If you recall, and certainly the media, the corporate media was good in its coverage of this, the police arrived like what I would call an invading army with these SWAT teams and military equipment to attack essentially people protesting. People who would think would have a right to protest, these are essentially unarmed civilians. What were these civilians looking at? They were facing military equipment. I didn't know of something called APCs. APCs are armed personnel carriers. This is something you bring into the, how do you say, the battlefield to, you know, transport troops. And popping out of these APCs are these heavily armed SWAT teams with these incredible weapons, which it's quite surprising. Now, in terms of funding, where's all this money coming from? You could trace it back to the Department of Defense 1033 program, and I would urge your listeners to look at this 1033 program. Quite interesting. Also from the Department of Homeland Security grants, they're giving money, free money, to local law enforcement to purchase all this military hardware. So now what I'm again suggesting, when you have such militarization of policing, the police are now being trained from what I believe they should have always been, but I would now say they are no longer. They are not a social service function. They are what I would characterize as having a warrior mentality. They enter these communities as an invading army entering enemy territory. And this to me is a very scary proposition here. Now, if you look at the Obama administration, and this I'm pulling right out of Pentagon data, police departments have literally received tens of thousands of machine guns nationwide. over 200,000 ammunition magazines, thousands upon thousands of pieces of camouflage, night vision equipment, hundreds upon hundreds of silencers, armed cars, aircraft. This is going into people's neighborhoods, right? But let me just say this, not to get too much on a tangent, which to me says a whole lot about the political bias in terms of use of all this militarization of the police and the use of this hardware. It's primarily, this goes primarily into minority communities. Typically in, you know, white, middle-class suburban Americas, you know, the police knocking down your doors and throwing flash, you know, grenades into your house. Now, what is supporting this? We have political support. We have our congressional representatives. We have senators who clearly benefit from this, what I call in political terms, pork barrel legislation. They get money to these companies, and in turn, these companies who provide these weapons obviously fund their campaigns. These politicians then proclaim, obviously, their unwavering support for defense spending, and this is the disingenuous rationalization that this is just job creation, which is far from it. Elected members of Congress are politically supporting permanent war now at home. So it has gone, I would argue, overseas to in the home front. And let me explain what the political terminology, and this is all new political terminology, to characterize what I call this permanent war on the domestic front. It's called front loading. Now, what I mean by front loading, we have members of Congress accepting the assurances of companies as to the new weapons capacity. So now you have this partnership here, even at home, to say we need to have these weapons and we get them through this partnership. We also have something called political engineering, in which we have defense and defense-related industries rewarding them with contracts in the congressional districts of these members of Congress. So all these associations and connections, again, they're not external. They're also internal. So they have the effect on how we see ourselves. And let me just mention this in terms of political psychology. You look and see this across the landscape, and we know of it. This creates just a climate of fear. We are a fearful society. We are afraid of the police. We are afraid of what they could do. We are afraid to demonstrate because in addition to targeting minority communities, they typically target protesters. So, again, this is here we are. We're going to come intimidate you. We're going to come and attack you. If you look at, just to mention this little tidbit here, the way the Occupy movement was shut down was precisely through this militarized policing. They came in and they brutally shut them down. Now, again, let's get back to the political angle here. Politicians want these defense companies in their districts. The companies and the military want to keep the funding high and also want to keep the wars going outside the United States. So the money does flow in terms of, I believe, Melman called it subsidy maximization. I believe he said this in Pentagon Capitalism. So they're living off, and he also called it parasitic growth, they live off tax dollars. So they really don't contribute much, in spite of what some politicians say, to the economy, certainly to the consumer economy. Now, let's talk about some direct effects on people, what I call the social effects, in terms of how this impacts on the working class and poorer populations in the United States. If you look at the condition of minorities, especially African Americans, they are overrepresented in the American military. And to me, that is quite telling. It says that their opportunities in terms of the finding jobs in the economy are quite limited. Now, if you look at elites, in effect, they're responsible for promoting the wars, which in turn send lower and working class young adults, men and women, to fight these wars, to do their fighting, I say. So more African Americans and poorer Americans are being killed, wounded, or suffering from severe stress when they come back from these campaigns. Now, when they return, what do they face? And this is the sad fact, which Even the Obama administration has been forced to accept severe unemployment, and never mind the psychological and physical issues that they do face. So this is permanent war, domestic, overseas. Now, in addition to the domestic institutional supports, we have, which certainly keeps it going, this manufacturing of threat, which ISIS is the latest. So what is the direct result? We need weapons. They must be used, and they must be sold to support our ongoing war-making. So we get what's called the shipment or the export of a pretty viable international arms market, which the U.S. is the leading exporter of weapons overseas. And one place it's been going to as of late, it's gone to many other places as well, is Iraq. But this is profit. There is profit in war making, okay? They were what are called war profiteers, and these companies are in the business to keep war going, to perpetuate the wholesale distribution of these weapons. And also, once the country has been devastated, once we've gone over there and waged war, now there are business opportunities by Cheney's old company. I forget the name of this company.
Halliburton.
Yeah, Halliburton is one. So that's the global arms market out there. They're involved in this buying and selling of weapons. And I can tell you, this is a pretty lucrative market, whether you talk about Israel or Saudi Arabia. Those are big recipients in the Middle East who are supporting U.S. Interests in that region of the world. So they are also going there. And if you look inside these countries, which we don't often see if you from the corporate media, in these countries, what has been built up are large stockpiles of weapons to coincide what is in and around, in many countries in the world, an empire of bases. And if you look at Chalmers Johnson, this is a lot of what he talked about in his book. America has thousands of these bases, which, again, is the institutional support for permanent war. But from these bases, that's where they stage attacks against these so-called manufactured threats. Now, again, when you look at what is what I call upholding or supporting permanent war, you need the what I call the other technological aspect, and that's why we have the enormous proliferation, not just now inside the United States, but overseas of drones. Now, drones kill these so-called terrorist suspects, but mostly innocent civilians. But now what I finally want to say, let's look at the real downside, the downside of permanent war, certainly what it's going to mean long-term for the United States. And to me, this is the most troubling aspect. Now, here's what is the current situation as of 2014, economically speaking. The United States is not the world's number one economic power. We still are maintaining military dominance, but that's slipping too. But the U.S. now faces global competition. The U.S. economically is confronting declining areas for U.S. investment. So what is the resort? Military intervention. This is how we try to use the military to essentially solve our continuing economic decline. And that's how we should see militarism. It's trying to do something which to me is kind of now becoming, I hate to use this word, inevitable. But the military now is the force to protect, preserve, and open up supposed new markets. And war making is the way to do it, to overcome the resistance. But there is short-term and long-term effects of this. In the short term, it does seem to perhaps open up new markets. But in the long term, it is further weakening the United States, and particularly domestically. And I would dare suggest, if you look at some particulars here, you'll find indications that we're starting to feel the real effects of this ongoing permanent war in the United States. Let's talk about, again, Bush-Obama. Let's talk about the Bush-Obama wars, just in two places here, Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, the estimates I've seen, and I've seen estimates even higher than this, but they are, at a minimum, these two wars have cost us domestically $4.4 trillion. I have no way of imagining what $4.4 trillion. And I have seen estimates as high as $6 trillion.
Andrew,
what I am suggesting to your listeners is this cannot be sustained.
Andrew, let me throw another number at
sure.
you. I can give it to you approximately. I wrote an article about this based on a Reuters article some months back. I think it might have been about a year ago or so. But it mentioned that roughly from 1996, and I think the time frame went either through 2011 or 2012, the Pentagon literally was guilty of grand theft to the extent of something like $8 or $9 trillion in waste, fraud, and abuse, and nobody knows where the hell this money went.
Yes, exactly. And that's what, again, if I may, I've been talking a lot about him this segment. Melman talks of this is kind of built in and the corruption, but also what he calls cost overruns. There's simply very little, if any, restraint on the building of these weapons and what the military can spend. It basically has what I call a cash cow by the support that Congress and the President appropriate monies. Exactly. So it's, but the, to me, troubling aspect is it's draining money away from essential domestic money that we need, because it's a shift in emphasis. That's the domestic consequences. And let's look at, again, some of these domestic consequences. Our priorities, I would argue, are quite skewed. The skewing of our priorities is neglect of job creation, of upholding and supporting a domestic economy. There's been some pretty serious neglect now for many, many decades. Okay, and let me indicate what some of the indications are. One is what I call, and there's been a lot written on it, the deindustrialization of the United States. And I don't have to tell your listeners, I'm sure they're aware of this, the key to a strong economy is a strong industrial base. And since the 1980s, that has been what various administrations and economic elites have been pursuing, shipping production facilities overseas to China and India. And as a result, unions declined, whole communities are being decimated, and there's been what I call the appearance and virtual growth of, in fair number of communities, especially out west, of ghost towns, simply places that are now people can't live anymore because the companies have closed up shop and went overseas. So we have products which used to be at the heart of our industrial base that really made the country the economic powerhouse it was right after World War II and at least till the late 60s. They're no longer being produced here. We used to produce and was the leader, as you know, in cars, radios, TV, electrical parts, machine tools. That's not the case. The reason is that R&D money, research and development money, and government financing doesn't go to those things. It goes, that is R&D money, towards the creation of these fancy schmancy weapons to engage in war. So the social effects are pretty clear. We see declining social welfare services. We see no innovations in the areas of medicine. We see the devastating effects on our education system. And in fact, let me just say one other thing about medicine, what is now the current state of affairs. The U.S. medical planners are in the works and developing plans to recruit large numbers of nurses from India. We are no longer even training nurses here. So again, we have serious neglect here, and this is the effect of all this. Education, look at the inner cities. We have a two-tiered education system. We have the well-off. We have those school systems in the suburbs, which, given who lives in these well-off suburbs, they have great schools. And then we have the schools in the inner cities or in working-class neighborhoods, which are second-tier. Quality isn't good because the funding isn't there. And so we have, again, enormous inequality being perpetuated, and that's certainly one of the roots of it. If your education is unequal, you know how that translates. Now, we also have, I can tell you, enormous problems in terms of housing shortages. Okay, we have a lot of people who are increasingly homeless or living in subpar housing. We're living on the streets. We have millions of young people who have to go to college, but what happens because of the federal government and state commitment to higher ed, they have cut funding of higher ed. The typical student comes out of college very much into debt, and I haven't seen the latest statistics, but I know it's something. The last I saw, this was just a few years ago, it's over $20,000 typically for an undergraduate, and I know it's even much higher if they go on to graduate school.
And except for mortgage debt, Andrew, it is the highest amount of debt. It's like a mortgage.
So how can we expect students to be gainfully employed when they're shouldering this kind of debt? And the last thing I want to say to kind of even wrap this up, to me this kind of says it all, is to talk about somebody by the name of Jack Welch. I don't know if your listeners know. I'm sure you know, Steve, who Jack Welch is.
Guy.
Yes, former head of General Electric. And I think the policies and attitude of Jack Welch kind of sums it all up as to what is the domestic effects of a permanent war economy, economically speaking. Now, I'll make a very long story short. Jack Welch downsized when he came on to head GE to make GE what I call lean and mean. He did this in part by relocating the largest R&D plants to none other than India. GE closed and sold 98 plants in the United States. The General Electric workforce in India now numbers, thanks to the efforts of Jack Welch, it numbers in the tens of thousands of Indian workers, not U.S. workers. And the type of workforce that now left the United States, moved by GE to India, includes middle-class jobs. So this, I'm not talking about the domestic the effects of a war economy, it's just the effects of workers and minorities and poor. The main exporting of jobs by a company that GE, which used to be quote-unquote white-collar jobs, he has exported jobs dealing with finance information, technology support, R&D for medical, lighting, and aircraft technologies. That's all white-collar stuff. That's no longer based here. GM bases these jobs in India, where, of course, the labor is much cheaper. So the white-collar is clearly feeling the pinch. And let me cite another statistic, because this one I had came across in some recent literature on the fate of the middle class, which I'm sure you and your listeners know is ever-shrinking and will probably disappear. As of 2015, the number of white-collar jobs slated to move offshore is expected to be 3,300,000. So goes your middle class. And that's been the, I can tell you, post, again, World War II, been part of the reason we had, a good standard of living. That and the decline of unions, because unions also contributed to that. Now, we also have other disturbing symptoms moving away just from Jack Welch, public debt, which and levels of taxation. These all increase when you go overseas and wage war. These are also, these are domestic effects. So again, you can't isolate one from the other. We have...
Let me cut in very briefly.
Sure.
This has been a terrific explanation of things going on, and you do it so well. Unfortunately, we are slaves to the clock, and the clock is about to run out. So let me just say, if you could wrap up very quickly with a couple of key things you want to say, when the music begins, I'm afraid I have to end the program.
Okay. All right, thanks for having me.
Oh, no. A quick point or two that you want to make.
Oh, okay. Let me make just... say a couple of quick things here, just to not leave your viewers and you on a on a down note here. There is possibilities here, and I do think the possibilities are in these kind of areas that most Americans certainly are not as supportive as the Obama and Bush administration would think of these wars. Certainly, if you think of when we waged war in Iraq, we had the largest demonstrations in human history against these wars before and during the war. So there's resistance to militarism. The second thing, there could be alternatives if the political will is there. And I would dare suggest if things get bad enough, there might very well be a political will, such as An alternative to this is to reindustrialize, move the economy away from this dependence on these corporations, and to build an industrial infrastructure. Those are the 2 points I really want to make before we close.
Oh, I appreciate it, Andrew. I'm just about to be cut off. The program was absolutely marvelous. I look forward to having you back.
I look forward to be back.
Oh, it's so much going on, Andrew, and it's so important to keep hammering on these things and get people to understand what's happening, and most important, to get people to tell other people, because the people who understand or listen to programs like this, they need to talk to people who don't listen to these type programs.
Exactly.
So they'll
yes.
understand. Andrew, many, many thanks. We'll talk soon.
I thank you. Yes.
Tune in always to PRN and to this program. Make it a regular habit.